This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. In his new book, writer Michael Sokolov looks back at a group of gifted young ballplayers from a high school in South Central Los Angeles who seemed to have the talent to take on the world. The most famous member of Crenshaw's class of 1979 was Daryl Strawberry, the sweet-swinging outfielder who won World Series championships with the Mets and the Yankees, but whose career was torn by drug use, alcoholism, and charges of spousal abuse and tax evasion. Sokolov wanted to find out what had become of Strawberry's classmates and see whether their achievements on the field had opened doors in life and given them tools to succeed. The team rolled to the L.A. City Championship in Dodger Stadium, but lost to a team with future Hall of Fame quarterback John Elway. Michael Sokolov is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, who's written on a variety of topics. He's also the author of Hustle, The Myth, Life, and Lies of Pete Rose. His new book is The Ticket Out, Daryl Strawberry and the Boys of Crenshaw. How good was this bunch of baseball players in Los Angeles?
Well, they were an extraordinary team. Some scouts have told me that they were probably the greatest assemblage of high school talent ever. Certainly one indication of that is that the great Daryl Strawberry was the right fielder for this team, and Daryl's teammates, quite rightly, did not even consider him the best player on that team. In fact, in Daryl's senior year, when he was the number one draft pick in the entire nation, the most coveted player, you know, to Major League Baseball, another player on that team, Reggie Dimeley, was the MVP of the L.A. High School League. So this was just an amazing group of players who just mashed the ball. I mean, they were hitters, they were offensive players, and they beat teams, you know, 16-2, 19-3. They were a very powerful group of young men.
It was an all-black baseball team in South Central Los Angeles. I guess there was one exception. There was one Panamanian player. And we often think of black kids, even in the 70s, in the city as being more focused on basketball. Why did these kids play baseball?
Well, they had fathers who played. They had fathers who played the game very well and in some cases were still playing it on the sandlots of Los Angeles. Daryl Strawberry's father was a great baseball player. Chris Brown remembers his father in his 40s, you know, playing on the sandlot, and he would remember going out and watching his father pulverize the ball. His father was a huge hitter like Chris himself was and like so many of these boys were, and they had grandfathers who played on the sandlots down south, so the neighborhood just had baseball in the blood. And I think of these young men who I wrote about, or I wrote about them as young men in the beginning, I think of them as the last group of great black athletes who wanted to play baseball most of all. And they all could have played other things. Daryl Strawberry could have played anything. Chris Brown was the three-time winner of the National Punt, Pass, and Kick competition, which is sort of a silly competition, but it reveals some great athletes. They were ball players, and to them, ball players meant baseball players. And that really is different from what we see in the inner city now, and it's different from really what existed in most other cities even at that time in the late 70s.
Los Angeles is a big city with a lot of high schools that I'm sure vary in their socioeconomic status of the students and parents. Crenshaw was a mostly minority school. What kind of equipment, fields, and facilities did these kids have as compared to some of their competition?
Well, in the inner city, you know, the ball fields were pretty rough. The baseball was not a big thing at too many other schools except Crenshaw High. But the Crenshaw Diamond was a little jewel. For a whole month or even 2 months before the season, the coach of this team, Brooks Hurst, would have these boys out there every gym class on their hands and knees, you know, mining pebbles from the diamond and grooming the field and watering the field and doing what they could with the grass. And probably the only other field in inner city Los Angeles that was a finer field than the diamond at Crenshaw High School was Dodger Stadium. I mean, it was just a jewel in the midst of a pretty rough neighborhood.
Now, the coach, Brooks Hurst, was a white guy working in this with this all-black team. You write that he wanted them to learn to play the game the right way. What did that mean?
What that meant to the players was that Brooks wanted them to play baseball the white way. Again, seeing baseball as a white sport. And it was abundantly clear to them that they were sort of visitors in this world. So Brooks demanded a couple of things. One thing that he demanded was no back-talking to umpires, no talking to opponents, no hot-dogging, anything that might have been construed as stereotypically inner city. Brooks put his foot down. You do that, you have a seat next to me on the bench. So one of it was behavior. The other was that they were to learn the game in a cerebral way. It was made clear to them that baseball is the thinking man's game. They had to learn to hit behind the runner. If there was a runner on second base, hit the ball to the right side, advance them to third base. They had to learn to bunt. They had to learn the proper way of sliding. All these small things, which in fact this team, with its abundant talent, probably didn't need to know. Brooks made sure that they did know, and they were very proud of that. And they even spoke this archaic lingo of baseball. You know, they called a pop-up a can of corn. They called a ball that fell into the outfield, if it was a pop fly, a Texas leaguer. So they here were these black kids from South Central L.A., and sometimes their diction sounded like something out of one of those old Chip Hilton novels. It was very, very funny to hear about this.
Now, Brooks Hurst was working with kids who came from, you know, probably a fairly macho street culture. I mean, not particularly known for, you know, submission to authority. Did he have trouble getting these guys to pay attention, to practice, to exhibit the kind of discipline he sought?
All young kids, all young baseball players have a hard time paying attention at practice. The baseball practice traditionally consists of hitting practice, fielding practice, way too much standing around. Brooks was a genius at keeping things moving. He had stations where they would, you know, swing a bat against some hanging tires to do something. I'm not even sure what that was for. And they would quickly move to another station. They did some martial arts for footwork and balance. So he really had them moving. So on a good day, they were paying attention. But what they really lived for was to hit. And batting practice was like a show and a competition. And one guy would grab the bat, and he'd sort of take aim at the Whitney Young Continuing Education Building over the center field fence. And he'd hit the ball over the fence and hand the bat to somebody else, and somebody else would take a whack at the center field fence. And then somebody else would hit the ball over the left field fence and over 8th Avenue and onto the yard of the old man who hated for balls to land on his yard. And he'd come out and he'd grab the ball and he would sort of gesticulate and yell, and the whole team would crack up. And this was the idea of the game. And then somebody would throw the bat to the next guy. And they all used the same bat, by the way. They used this orange bat called the Tennessee Thumper. And somebody tried to hit the ball in the old man's yard again. And these guys were so good, they could just pound this ball, you know, into this guy's yard time after time. And, of course, these are 15, 16, 17-year-old boys, and this was just great fun.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with author Michael Sokolov. His book is The Ticket Out. It's an account of an incredibly talented group of high school ballplayers in South Central Los Angeles, which included, among others, the great Daryl Strawberry. Well, let's talk about Daryl Strawberry. He was an enormous talent. What kind of family situation did he come from?
Daryl's family was not, first of all, desperately poor. His mother worked for Pacific Bell. His father had work. But when Daryl was 13 years old, and his father, you know, it was a very turbulent household to begin with in terms of his parents' marriage. When Daryl was 13 years old, his father got in a terrible row with his mother, very bad scene in the house, and Daryl and his two older brothers essentially pushed his father out of the house. You know, that was it. The boys said, you know, you're out of here. And the father was never to return. And there were many other fatherless boys on this team, on the Crenshaw 79 team, and certainly many other fatherless boys in that neighborhood. But Daryl's makeup was whatever hit Daryl, it hit him harder. Daryl was tender, vulnerable, sort of constitutionally sad, and this moment just stayed with Daryl. Daryl losing his father was devastating to him, and in many ways something he never got over. And Daryl spent a lifetime sort of looking for father figures in Major League Baseball, looking for a certain kind of love that's just not forthcoming. Darryl wanted to be loved for being Darryl Strawberry. And pro sports is not that way. You're loved for hitting home runs. And this is something that Darryl continually did not understand. And I trace it back really to this moment.
Well, he was loved for his talent, and you described that at some length. Give us a little glimpse of what people saw when they looked at Darryl Strawberry, this young athlete.
Darryl was, first of all, physically beautiful in an athletic way. Darryl was 6'5 by the time he came up to the big leagues. He was very strong, but at the same time very lean, and he had this looping uppercut that if God wanted to create a home run hitter, if you believe in that kind of thing, he would have given a slugger Darryl's left-handed swing. In addition to all of this, Darryl could run, Darryl could throw, Darryl could field his position. So when scouts said that Darryl was possibly the greatest prospect they ever saw, sometimes when scouts say that and a guy doesn't measure up, scouts just were wrong about a player's physical talent, but no one was wrong about Darryl. Darryl had everything, and in addition, he was just a pure beauty to watch. You couldn't take your eyes off Darryl.
When baseball players are drafted by big league teams, it's usually for a lengthy apprenticeship in the minor leagues, lasting years, with the hope they'll eventually make it to the major leagues. What kind of expectations accompanied Darryl Strawberry's draft after he finished high school?
Darryl was the first draft pick in the entire nation. He had already been written about by Sports Illustrated. He had been written about by other publications. He was called countless times the Black Ted Williams. So Darryl Strawberry was never going to spend very long in the minor leagues. You know, he was anticipated from the moment he was drafted. And remember, he was drafted by a New York team. He was drafted by the Mets. So that increases the attention, the anticipation. And there were fans in New York who knew of Darryl Strawberry and were waiting for Darryl Strawberry. And the Mets at that time were a woeful team, just a terrible team. They had just sunk, you know, to being a little above AAA level. So Darryl was rushed through the minor leagues, and he was rushed through the minor leagues because they needed his talent. And they also needed his star quality and his resonant name and, you know, all the things that he could do for them at the box office. But the model in baseball is to give a young player lots and lots of seasoning, you know, to with all that that implies, both emotional maturity and baseball seasoning. And Darryl, as a first-round pick of a lowly franchise, was not going to get any of that.
So he goes into the minor leagues. He's away from home on his own, recognized as an enormous talent, being paid to play ball. Did he get into trouble in the minor leagues?
Darryl did get into trouble in the minor leagues. Some of it not amounting to much. He struggled some. At one point, he was sleeping essentially all day long until a teammate said, "Darryl, you know what? You got to get up. You got to get your blood moving a little bit before you go to the ballpark. Otherwise, you can't perform." And, you know, looking back on that, I wonder, from my armchair psychologist point of view, I wonder if Darryl was depressed at that time, just sleeping all day. More significantly, there were two incidents where Darryl got in trouble for his behavior toward women. His agent at the time described it to me as tiny rough stuff. I have no idea what that means. I have no idea if it felt like tiny rough stuff to the hotel chambermaid who lodged a police complaint. But this was rose to the level of the police coming to the hotel in Florida where he was training, and it was said to me that this was made to go away. Darryl's agent at the time and the general manager of the New York Mets, Frank Cashin, both used that term. It went away. And I said, "Well, how did it go away?" "Well, they didn't really remember." "Well, was money paid?" "Well, I didn't pay any money, but maybe the agent did." And the agent says, "Well, I didn't pay any money, but maybe Frank Cashin did." We can sort of imagine how these things might have gone. But the point is, this is the kind of treatment that a superstar athlete got then. It's the kind of treatment that a superstar athlete still gets, and it's the kind of small accumulation of breaks that someone has cut that eventually leads to, you know, all kinds of forms of misbehavior. And then we say, well, how did that happen? And you sort of see it from the beginning.
You write that he was held to a new, lower standard as a professional. How did he behave when he got to the Mets? Big league phenomenon in the biggest media market in the nation.
Well, in the beginning, he behaved pretty well. His work ethic toward baseball was never great, but his talent was vast. So when people said that he was the next Ted Williams, for 4 or 5 years, you could imagine that. Because Darryl hit a lot of home runs, and Darryl won a lot of games for the Mets, and Darryl was the center of some really good teams, including the 1986 National League and World Series championship team. So in a baseball sense, Darryl behaved pretty well. But this was 1980s New York. This was Studio 54. This was cocaine. And the Mets were literally the toast of the town. And Darryl was a young kid from South Central L.A., suddenly thrown into the midst of all of this. So his personal habits and his behavior declined, and eventually so did his performance on the field.
Were there arrests? Were there incidents?
In the beginning, with the Mets, there were not arrests, there were not incidents. People tend to turn a blind eye when someone is performing on the field like Darryl was. But his behavior was in plain view, and the warning signs were in plain view. But in sports, you know, sports is not a big enlightened venue, and baseball is the most hidebound of all sports. So the Mets essentially said, you know, Darryl's a kid, Darryl's having a good time, Darryl's hitting home runs, everything is okay. Well, everything really wasn't okay, and even his behavior among his teammates started to decline. Darryl's not by nature a mean human being, but Darryl could be a very mean drunk, and there were some very ugly scenes with teammates that started developing on the team bus, on the team plane. There was a teammate, Gary Carter, a catcher, great ball player, sort of struggling his way toward 300 career home runs and hitting about 200 as he tried to eke out some more home runs. And Darryl just stayed all over him, stayed on him about his salary. Ball players rib each other about little stuff. But there are lines that are not crossed, and Darryl crossed all the lines with Gary Carter.
Why does a guy who was a nice guy, who was in some way sort of a naive guy, maybe even a bit of a pushover, how does he get to be so angry and aggressive?
Well, that's a really difficult question, of course. Certainly, alcohol and cocaine and addiction in general will make you, I suppose, angry and aggressive. And the cauldron of sports, which is so warping, which in so many ways is so corrupting, I think will change your personality and did change Darryl's personality. I mean, Darryl, as so many of these guys did, started to have a whole entourage around him. There was a guy out on the road with him, a buddy from high school, whose entire role in life was to go to clubs with Darryl and to procure women and to procure drugs. So this is not a healthy situation, obviously.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Let's return to our conversation with writer Michael Sokolov. His new book looks at a talented class of high school ballplayers from poor families in South Central L.A. Their 1979 team was so good, even the bench players got pro contracts. Sokolov's book is The Ticket Out, Darryl Strawberry and the Boys of Crenshaw. When we left off, we were talking about Darryl Strawberry's early years in pro ball. He has 6 great seasons in the major leagues. He hits more home runs in his first 6 years than Mickey Mantle did. But eventually, addiction catches up. A marriage breaks up. There are trades. There are rehabs. And you spent some time with Darryl Strawberry at a time later in his career after he'd had a lot of problems and bounced through several franchises and several rehab centers and was making a comeback, I guess at about age 37, with the New York Yankees. How did he do? I mean, at this point, he'd had some miles under him, maybe learned some things.
Darryl did very well in many ways. You know, Darryl's capacity for drama is extreme. So Darryl started the 1996 baseball season with the St. Paul Saints. St. Paul Saints are what's called an independent minor league team. That means they're not even part of the real minor leagues. They're one step from a Sunday beer league. And Darryl's reputation and performance in baseball had so declined that that's where Darryl ended up. By the end of that season, Darryl was up with the Yankees, hitting October home runs. I mean, this was just amazing. Nobody else could go from the St. Paul Saints to the New York Yankees in October.
But in the end, there's a relapse. He goes back to a rehab center, and a day before he's to get an overnight pass to go finally visit his family, he's remarried now, he splits, goes on a four-day binge. So the old demons came back.
The old demons came back. I talked to Darryl the night before he took off. We had a beautiful phone conversation. At that point, I was just starting out on the magazine story that I wrote for the New York Times Magazine on Darryl. And we would talk just about every night. One of the things that I remember is there was always Motown music playing in the background, the Four Tops, the Supremes, and that reminded me that Darryl was not part of the misbehaving hip-hop generation of young athletes. Darryl was what used to be called an old head. Darryl was at that point 37, 38. And we had this nice talk, and Darryl told me how well he was doing and how healthy he felt and how much he was looking forward to going home and seeing his wife, Charisse, and his children. The next thing you know, he took off. Darryl had no explanation for that. I have no explanation for that. And this is the great frustration of Darryl Strawberry. Darryl really couldn't tell you what drove him to do that.
Darryl Strawberry spent a lot of time in rehab circles and 12-step programs, and a lot of people who go through that develop what they believe is a personal relationship with God. How did Darryl see God's role in his life?
Well, that's an interesting question. And the last time I was with Darryl in Florida, not long after he got out of jail, he was in jail for breaking his probation on his last drug charge. And I was in Darryl's house in Florida, and he was very happy, and he was padding around in his slippers and just sort of lord of the manor and relaxed. Baseball was over, and we talked about some of these things. And Darryl said to me, essentially, God did not intend for me to be a great ball player. All the missteps I've taken, God guided me toward them. And I challenged him on that. I said, Darryl, what do you mean? God, if you believe in such, God gave you this Hall of Fame physique. He gave you this beautiful swing. Don't you think God might be a baseball fan? Don't you think God might have intended you to reach Cooperstown, to reach the Hall of Fame? Otherwise, why else would he give you Hall of Fame talent? And Darryl just would have none of that. Darryl, as you say, sort of did fall back into this language of, you know, the recovery programs. And he said, the one thing I remember him saying to me is, God cannot use a prideful person. So Darryl's life has consisted largely of giving up his pride. And that is his theology. I mean, that is the way he sees things.
You track down quite a number of Darryl Strawberry's high school classmates at Crenshaw High, this great team from the 1970s, and found, I guess, most of them had had some experience with pro ball. One of them, Chris Brown, actually had a short but successful major league career, but kind of came to be regarded by a lot of writers as a complainer and a maligner. Tell us about Chris Brown's major league experience.
I was fascinated by what I learned about Chris Brown. Chris had a very short career despite his tremendous talents. He had a very short major league career. He was seen as someone who would not play hurt. He was seen as a malingerer, and he was seen as less than manly. He was a wimp. A newspaper account sometimes referred to him as Chris Downtime Brown because he missed so much. Well, I caught up with Chris. Chris was operating a crane in Houston. Chris was a family man with a couple of kids. Told me how he taught his son to cut the grass. And for months, his son had to cut the grass in the backyard before he'd let him cut the grass in the front yard. The front yard was the part of his lawn that he showed to his neighbors, and that had to be just right. So Chris was fastidious and, in some very traditional sense, a man of duty, driving a crane. And it was fascinating to me that his reputation in baseball was so different. I got a call from Chris Brown about a week ago. His crane operating job in Houston had dried up, and Chris was calling me from his new job site. He was driving an 18-wheeler, a fuel truck, for Halliburton in downtown Baghdad. And this is the man who was not manly enough to make it in pro sports.
You know, as I read the accounts of the members of the Crenshaw High team that you tracked down, it struck me that, you know, given that they were coming from, not maybe the toughest neighborhood in L.A., but certainly a lot of them came from poor backgrounds, that a lot of these guys had done pretty well for themselves. One of them was a successful executive chef. Another had a military career, and quite a number of them seemed solid, had solid jobs and families. You write early in the book that you'd kind of always explored this idea, wanted to explore this idea that sports at its best would uplift, that it would build character and reward merit without prejudice. What does the experience of these high school players at Crenshaw tell us about that image of sports?
I think that sports gave them some discipline. I think that it gave them a sense of themselves when they were young. And those were very positive things. Ultimately, they invested so much in it, and in most cases got so little out of it, that sports became something else that they had to overcome. They had to overcome the time they put into it at the exclusion of other things, and they had to overcome the loss of it. They had to overcome some very unfair things that happened to them along the way. Reggie Dimely went out to play college baseball at the University of Hawaii. Reggie was one of the brightest guys on this team, very bright guy. He went out there and signed himself up for business courses, computer courses, history courses. Coach changed all his courses. Among the courses he had were military history and military tactics, and they taught him how to fire a rifle. And Reggie said, "Why did I leave South Central LA to learn how to shoot a gun? That's the last thing that I want to learn how to do. I've seen enough gunfire." So this quite understandably soured him, and this was sort of the end of his baseball career, being put into this kind of situation by someone who just saw him as a jock and saw him as a kid from the inner city who did not need education.
You tracked the Crenshaw High School players down 20 years or so after they'd had this glorious season, and many of them had tried pro ball and have gone a whole different, lot of different ways. How do they regard baseball now? Do they follow it? Do they play it recreationally? Does it hurt to think about it? What's their attitude toward baseball?
Most of them do not follow baseball. For a couple of them, it does hurt to think about. Some of them are very wounded. Some of them, you know, still have very raw feelings about how baseball ended for them. There's one player, Marvin McWhorter, who was the one who read Ted Williams' Science of Hitting 4 times, committed the whole thing to memory. Marvin still plays softball. Marvin is very into baseball. Marvin was probably more into baseball, you know, than anyone but Carl Jones going way back. Most of the others have moved on to basketball and football, as some would say, like most of the rest of America has, or much of the rest of America. Interestingly, they cannot get their sons interested in baseball, even the ones who have tried to get their sons interested. Daryl Strawberry's son, DJ, was a wonderful baseball player in Southern California, one of the best 14, 15-year-old baseball players in the whole state. DJ is now a very good guard for University of Maryland's basketball team. George Cook, one of the second basemen, his son was also a very good baseball player, just stopped playing in his mid-teens, and his son, Ashanti, is the point guard for Georgetown. So the boys of Crenshaw, their grandfathers passed baseball on to their fathers, and their fathers passed baseball on to them, but even the ones who have tried could not pass baseball on to their own sons.
Writer Michael Sokolov. His book is The Ticket Out, Daryl Strawberry and the Boys of Crenshaw. Since we taped our interview, Chris Brown was touched by the recent violence in Iraq when his truck convoy was attacked by insurgents. His family reports that he's okay.